This is the Crate and Crowbar, episode 96. It's the 9th of June, and this is a podcast about PC games, and I am Tom Francis. With me here today are...
Tom Senior.
And...
Marge Davies.
Ring announcer voice.
And it's all hotting up. E3 is going to happen next week, and so there's loads of new stuff being announced and talked about. I would say, like, one of the biggest heavy hitters of the AAA world has revealed their massive new thing. Human Resources, Tomorrow Corporation, which is partially, there's one of the two people behind World of Goo, plus, I think, is it the other Kyle as well, is it the same people who did Little Inferno? Same two So Kyle Gabler is the one of the two brains behind World of Goo, and after that he made Little Inferno with another Kyle, whose surname I forget, and I think that is Tomorrow Corporation, and that's who's behind this new game, Human Resources, which... is very, very much visually in the style of Little Inferno's kind of... I can't even reference what it's in the style of without spoiling Little Inferno.
Oh, really?
Well, it's like 1930s cinematic style.
Yeah, yeah, I guess... Yeah, they did that video, didn't they? Very much like that. And you get glimpses behind the sinister corporation behind that sells Little Inferno. And it might even be the same corporation in this, and you are... I don't think you actually are a worker. I think you're kind of like a manager in a massive corporation, and you have to sort of program your workers. And that means there's like boxes coming on the left, and you've got to put them on a conveyor belt on the right, and they've got to be in a certain order, I think. And in the middle, you can kind of store them up, and you have to specify a series of commands that your worker will execute, I think, on a loop in order to get him to process those things into the way that management wants it. And so it's a lot like Infinity Factory. It's a lot like Space Chem, in principle at least. But it looks like the way you actually do this is rather than drawing conveyor belts in 3D space or rotating molecule machines in Space Chem, it looks like you actually place lines of code. And I don't think you write them. I think you kind of choose from a set of instructions and then compose an algorithm. Which is also something that other games have done, like Hack and Slash. I never actually played that, but...
Coding's cool now. All the programmers are going, yeah, why don't we make a game about making games?
That's exactly what Graham said earlier. It's a thought that occurs to every puzzle designer at some point, because they will have to write code, so it's something they all know about. Mm. And at some point, realize that, hey, this is just like solving a puzzle. Other people should do this.
That's the creator of Philip actually recently released.
Oh, yeah.
A puzzle game about coding that is so obtuse I've not dared to even download it yet. But it's clearly like a game made for programmers, right?
Where are all
it's...
the fucking puzzle games about drawing goblin cocks? I don't know. My demographic is being underserved here.
Yeah. It's because they can't evaluate art. Like, computers can't judge whether you're doing a good job or not. They can tell whether you traced a circle accurately.
That's what I love about Infinite Factory and loved about Space Chem was that you're manipulating physical space in front of you in an interesting way. Whereas, to me, creating lines of instructions is just, in a tactile sense, far less interesting than, you know, most puzzle games.
Yeah. It's hard to... You don't... From the trailer, you don't really see it being played exactly, I don't think. Or you see, like, very short snippets, so you don't really get a sense for what the moment-to-moment interactions are. So it remains to be seen.
Is it going to have a patronising meta-narrative about the amount of fun that you should or shouldn't be having?
Would you be referring to Little Inferno, though?
Could be. I really did not like Little Inferno, because it was... it's based around the kind of simple iPhone game, Facebook game style, kind of cow clicker style, simple mechanics.
Yeah.
And the theme of the game seemed to be, why are you enjoying this? It's mindless. And I wasn't enjoying it, and at no point had I been under the illusion I would enjoy it, so it seemed like I was being punished and then told off for something I didn't experience.
Yeah, they did a talk at GDC, not last year, but I think the year before, about... I can't remember if it was about its failures specifically, but that's kind of what it ended up being. It was just a list of, like, here's what we did that we maybe shouldn't have done, or here's why it was difficult to make in this way, and that kind of thing.
Hmm.
And, yeah, getting people to understand, well, just that tension that you were referring to was a sticking point. Yeah, I don't know whether to be optimistic with this. They said they made it in 9 months or something, so it sounds like it's done. And... that that was a much happier way to work. I can't remember, how long did World of Goo take?
They seem to say it took them several years.
I think. Because that was, that game just had a huge amount to it, like it was just big, you know, it had a lot of levels, and then every chapter of levels was radically different to the last one, with whole new art and new mechanics and new concepts and stuff, which is what made it great, but also, yeah, not easy to make.
That also had a very tactile, like a beautiful sense of stickiness to the moving those blobs around, and that was, like, it's a real pleasure to interact with on a moment-to-moment basis, which it wasn't really. You're just like dragging and dropping things into a fire, and we'll have to see what this one is.
Little Inferno, you could like fling the things around. They did have a nice physicality to them. They would bump into each other, and then as they burnt, they returned slowly to ash and become more brittle as they sort of fell apart. So it was quite nice to toy around with. But yeah, the thing that was announced just before we started recording this was Mirror's Edge Catalyst.
Which is not a sequel, they say, whilst also describing it in all the ways that one would describe a sequel.
It's not a sequel because they're going to improve on it, and they're going to go deeper into the person's story. So
yeah, they're not like a sequel. Ever done that before.
So is this like an Evil Dead 2 to Evil Dead 1 scenario where basically they remake the same idea but with the resources and attention?
I don't know, Graham seems to suggest, I couldn't tell this from the press release I read, but Graham seems to suggest that it was a continuation of the story from the first game. Rather than a reboot or some kind of other parallel universe thing. I don't know, but I'm sure it'll look very nice indeed.
Yeah, the art they're showing to sort of announce this is Mirror's Edge 1 art. Like, it might just be a concept they didn't use before. I think Faith now has like a little gadget on her arm in addition to
anything else. But looks like it might be a small taser or something.
I bet it's a fucking hard thing to like get instructions from. Like a Pip-Boy.
Her face has changed as well.
Yeah.
Bit of a shame. I like the original face.
Yeah.
It's elongated it actually, because the original face was very distinctly like Asian. Amazing, incredible design for Faith in the first game. She still looks pretty cool. But
she was quite different from concept art to concept art actually. Like the individual pieces, you'd see one where it's just like, oh, that's just a different person.
Oh, really? Huh?
Like, I think...
I've got the cover up there, actually. Do you want to grab that?
Where is it?
This is the, that red one there. Look at that.
This is amazing podcast material. Look at it, everyone. Look at it. That's so different.
That was the announcement. That was it was announced on the cover of Edge magazine, and one of the few games to be announced on the Edge, on Edge's cover, which wasn't immediately canned.
Yes, yes.
Although I think we did end up giving it 4. So we gave it a good go.
That's actually on the big thing about Mirror's Edge is that how device fit is. Like, some people just fucking hate it. Some people obviously look.
I didn't write that review, but I don't know if I would have given it even 4. No, I would have done it. I had a lot of. I did like a lot of things about it. I just found it so frustrating that I couldn't engage with the parts of it that I really enjoyed.
I remember having a conversation with I think Tim Clark and Dan Dawkins, who were respective editors of different console magazines at the time, and had both just reviewed Mirror's Edge, and so had I. And one of them, I think Tim Clark, was saying that Edge's 4 was generous. I'd just given it 84, I think. Was thinking maybe that's too low. Dan's opinion was somewhere in the middle, and we found that we just agreed on everything. None of us had any differing opinions about it. All of us thought the same things were great about it and the same things were bad about it. But just what that added up to was radically different.
So what was the point of the disagreement? Like, look, you two fight, but I'm asking you two to fight now, basically, is what's happening here.
If you watch me play it, you would think I was going to give it a 4, because I was screaming at them. I'm fuck's sake, come on!
The loss of momentum in that game is one of the most frustrating things in any game I've played, I think. Just when you slightly fuck something up, or you're just stopped.
I had a lot of missed grabs, like you have to grab onto railings and stuff, and just the timing of that is just very counterintuitive, if it's even logical. And at the time, I certainly felt it wasn't logical, and would repeatedly fail because of that. And because you care so much about things going well, like when it's going well, it feels so good, that anything that interrupts that is disproportionately infuriating. And so I was very angry in the moment, but then I would forgive it immediately because I was going to have that cool moment again afterwards.
And it looks fucking unique.
Yeah, it's just an amazing place, and I just felt like everyone should get this and go there and experience it a bit until they throw something at it.
Yeah, I wonder, I mean, it sounds like they're reappraising pretty much everything about the game, or at least that's what they've said.
Yeah, it was pretty hopeful, the press release. It was like, I think they even referred to Mirror's Edge 1 as promising, which is an incredibly harsh thing to say about your own game, but it's quite well liked. And yeah, they very much were trying to make it very clear we're going to reevaluate everything about it.
I love it to be actually faster, more fluid, and I think games like Titanfall done fast, fluid, free-running movement extremely well now.
Right.
So I wonder if they're looking at that stuff.
Yeah, it's kind of tied by the restrictions of Faith as a character. Like, I mean, she doesn't have jetpack feet or anything like that.
Come on, Faith, get it together.
You can screw with that stuff in a game, though. You can make people... Like, the thing with Total War games is always that I was talking to one of the developers, and they're like, actually, if you just look at how fast they're running, they're all Olympic sprinters.
Oh, yeah, no, I didn't... I meant more that, like, the thing about that game is that you have to have quite minute control over her actions.
Obviously,
like,
yeah.
She needs to duck, you need to press the duck button at the right time, or, you know, do all these things, whereas most other games just take care of that for you now. You automatically mantle over objects and stuff like that. Mm. I think Titanfall, you don't ever have to press a button if you hit a ledge. Like, you just grab onto it and climb up it automatically, yeah, I think, yeah. If you keep pressing forward.
Yeah.
And that's true of all the kind of new parkour games since then, like Assassin's Creed and stuff. And I wonder, I really like the kind of the minutiae of the control in Mirror's Edge. That was one of the things I did like about it. And it would be a shame to see that disappear, because I don't think that was the problem with the game. But I suspect they probably might just erase that, rub off its kind of sharper edges to make it something slightly easier to imbibe.
Might be a like right trigger to free run, and then she'll kind of figure it out for herself if it's sort of your peculiar direction.
Yeah.
Interesting.
There'll have to be an element of skill to it, because it's so much what the game is. Like, particularly if they're gonna,
Well, that's why they said it's not a sequel, because they want to kind of reset people's expectations.
But it also sounded like they were saying, I don't know, maybe it's just wishful thinking, but the press release read to me like the way I feel about it, which is they were so close to something amazing, but they fucked it up, and so now they're gonna take the thing that was amazing and not fuck it up. That's how I wrote it in the press release.
I don't think there was anything necessarily like intrinsically wrong with the idea. I think it produced like some tensions which are difficult to kind of get over. Like the fact that often in a game where you're being chased, the most interesting thing is behind you is just like a problem of framing that you can't really get around.
Just have a wing mirror.
I mean, that's what her wrist catcher is. It's just like a retractable wing mirror.
That's almost too realistic. I mean, like, it's almost too convincing that could happen.
And you want to enjoy those environments because they look so amazing. You also want to play with those environments and explore different routes through them. And you can never really do that because, like, you'd be shot in the back by a gunship that you couldn't see and you couldn't tell how close it was to you or how much threat there was. And those things are just... They're difficult to get around without kind of completely changing the parameters of the challenge. I think they probably should.
It'd be really cool to be... I mean, things that would fit with that fantasy that involve sort of hanging around in a space without necessarily breezing through it. Mm-hmm. It would be cool if you had to, like, scout out locations and figure out... Mm-hmm. So, you know, stand on a rooftop and plan out your next route, or maybe watch couriers running past and figure out which one you want to catch up with and intercept. I'm sure they won't do that because they will do something incredibly linear and plot-driven again. But if I was going to make like a more open-ended version of Mirror's Edge, that's what I'd love to see.
I think the skyboxes of that game create a false expectation of exploration and the ability to take multiple routes, whereas actually the routes were very prescribed throughout Mirror's Edge.
Yeah.
And actually almost like the marketing going up to it was kind of implied that you could pick your own route sometimes and there's a bit of variation.
Yeah,
Really,
there was in earlier designs of the game. They had it so that they were going to... You know, the environment kind of pops with certain colours.
Yeah.
Originally, I think it only ever pops with red.
Yeah.
But originally they were going to signpost it, so like a yellow route would be easier than a red route and a green route would be the easiest.
Like ski slopes.
And there would be options. And they also... This is such a good idea, but you quickly realise just how impossible it would ever be to implement. They were going to have it so that you'd always know which way would be a safe way to go because there would be light falling on it. So you'd know that if you jumped off a roof into shadow, you'd be plummeting to your death, but if you jumped off the roof into something which was broadly sun-splashed, you'd be going fine. But the problem is that would mean that the sun would have to be all over the place in order to ever change direction.
Yeah. Or it's really convenient searchlights that are just on in the middle of the day, illuminating random shadows thing.
Yeah, so that never would. I think the thing that frustrated me about it most was that I really liked it. I didn't even mind that the routes were prescribed in the end. I just didn't think that, and with all their efforts, they were always that well signposted. And occasionally, like, I think I missed, you know, there's a part where you first learn you can break glass because you're in an office and you run through some glass and it smashes.
Right.
I didn't do that because I went through the door. And so I never knew that I could break glass. And there's a critical moment later on where the only route that is possibly available to you is like, it's this thing you kind of need to chimney up, like, between two pieces of architecture and then leap back through, like, some plate glass. And I just had no idea that that would be even possible because some of the glass in the game is completely unbreakable. And I'd had run into that.
Right.
So I'd learnt that they shouldn't completely change everything about that game, I don't think. But maybe the things that were wrong about it were just kind of things that could be corrected with another layer of iteration, you know?
Mm. The most important thing to keep is that when you're sliding down a sloped surface and you have no weapon and you press attack, Faith just sticks up a middle finger. Like that. I think it's... I can't remember if you break the window, if the helicopter does, but helicopter shooting it, you can jump out of a window and you slide down this... skyscraper is like polished glass, and on the way down you can just stick up your little finger at the helicopter.
They were going to do a multiplayer for Mirror's Edge, but they cut that because it was too ambitious. But I'd really like to see like just Mirror's Edge / Crazy Taxi, basically, in an open world. That's what I like. I suppose, which is what Assassin's Creed multiplayer is, really. But, you know, with more of a kind of like prescribed obstacle course style
thing going on. Imagine chase sequences.
None of these things will happen. Who knows? It's going to be horrible, probably.
What else has been announced? There's some other news, I'm sure.
Last week we talked about Fallout, but only in the context of there was probably going to be a trailer that day, and we actually hadn't seen it.
Indeed.
And now we have.
It has lots of colours in it.
Yeah.
Which I feel mixed about.
Yeah, me too. Yeah. I mean, it's going to be great, because it's a Bethesda RPG, and I like all of them so far. but yeah, I felt like it wasn't as... They showed such a miscellany of things, I think to emphasise that there are different colours in it and it's not all brown. But the net effect was I didn't really get a sense of what this world feels like. It just seemed like, well, it's a bit like the real world, but things are ruined.
And there are boats, galleons with rockets on them.
Yeah.
That's
whereas actually... Fallout 3, if you show a bunch of shots from that, it comes through in all of them. This is just the whole world is fucking fucked forever. It's just absolutely desolate and smashed to pieces. And that was kind of compelling in its way.
The trailer was actually a little tour of Boston Monuments, of which that ship was one. So that was quite an intentional thing. It's a model of the ship, but they've obviously, for some reason, bolted massive.
Clobbered onto things. No, right. That's a Boston Monument, is it?
Yeah, I think it's they've got a ship in somewhere. Right. It's kind of like... I'll have to research.
Yeah, booster ship of Boston.
There are a few others as well. There's their baseball park is in there, and it's now a shanty town, and a few other places as well. But actually, Boston Monument's there. So yeah, that it was kind of a little nod to Bostonians who were watching that trailer, recognizing places.
They probably thought it was their reveal that it's set in Boston by showing all these really recognizable landmarks. Sort of sitting there thinking, British wasteland, I see.
British guys, it's kind of brown and red, isn't it? Can't really take anything else out of them.
The other thing about that trailer is it keeps switching to pre-war, to pre-apocalypse.
Do you think there's going to be two timelines in the game then?
Well, so that stuff looks like it's game assets. It doesn't look like it's completely pre-rendered. So I think there's going to be something that you play before the explosion. And Chris said the most depressing interpretation, which is, you'll play as your dad for a bit in the intro.
I think...
Which is probably true, but...
I think that... So in one of the screenshots, there's a kind of memory bank sign over a doorway. I think that, as in Fallout 3, there'll be ways to strap yourself in and play through missions that are set in the past. So they'll probably bring that back.
That makes sense. How long is it, like in Fallout 3, how long after the apocalypse is that set? Do we know?
No idea.
I don't remember.
No.
I'm just wondering if it's like even viable to have anything continuing over. Because it's generations, isn't it?
Since,
so you wouldn't... It's not like you'd be meeting the same people.
No.
Before and after.
You popped out of a different vault in a different circumstance. And it's interesting, they show you, like, the protagonist has Brotherhood of Steel armour, seemingly, like, just in his garage. and is seen wearing it, taken off in a ship, which feels like that's max level Fallout 3 stuff. That armor set, it's just like, if you've got that, you basically, you know, you can kill almost anything. So it's interesting if you're actually part of the Brotherhood of Steel, you're more empowered in this world than you were in Fallout 3, which might be a shame, because I love Fallout 3 for the sense of the road, basically, the wandering and, you know, discovering really quirky, strange things that Bethesda couldn't ever put into Skyrim. So the world of, you know, the Elder Scrolls would never allow for, you know, the bit of Fallout 3 where you find out two guys who are dressed as superheroes fighting with, one's got an army of giant ants and the other one's got an army of robots. And you just find that, just they're just fighting the open world and you can join part of the storyline and, you know, fight for one or the other. Like, there's so many instances of really just funny, quirky things in the Fallout universe that I'm really looking forward to rediscovering again.
The one bit of that trailer that really did excite me was zombie runs towards you and there's a shopping trolley in the way and the shopping trolley gets nudged out of the way. I was like, yes, look at that!
A lot of people have said that they're quite disappointed by the way the trailer looked because it's like, obviously the witch tree just come out.
Well, it's funny, on the last podcast I said, well, I kind of hope they don't do a big graphical upgrade because one of the problems I think with Bethesda have always had is kind of trying to keep up with the technology that they've forged for the next gen, and so, you know, that's why the games come out quite chunky, I think, because they're struggling to build a game within and build an engine at the same time. Mm. So it does look like they went with the last engine a little bit.
Yeah, it does. Look, it's telling that they didn't show any faces in the trailer, which has always been the weakest part of that engine. Inability to, you know, communicate a facial expression is always unrivaled like in modern game engines. It's like the most potato faced kind of immobile like facades of a human that you'll see in a game come from the Game Boy engine. So I love those games as well, but you know, that's a real problem with them when they're RPGs and it's all about interacting with humans.
There's a sort of extreme stiffness to all the people always as well, isn't it? Everyone stands bolt up
sometimes. It's really strange,
except when they're in generic combat pose, which seems to be the same for every model.
I wonder if they'll go back to the old slam zoom as well. The child asks you about his dead father and suddenly you're like, whoosh, right onto this child's face.
You shove your nose right in his grill. And what about your dead father?
My daddy's dead.
that's a problem.
They did get away with that. Oh, sorry, they did get rid of that for Skyrim. So
they did.
They realise it's...
They got a lot better Skyrim. I'm really excited, actually. I think... It's weird, really, because people complained about The Witcher 3 because there was a bit of a visual downgrade from their earlier projected, you know, target footage trailers to what actually the game looks like, even though the game looks fucking amazing now. And then, like, Bethesda clearly showed a trailer that is what the game is going to look like. And everyone's like, this looks like shit. What have you done to us?
Why are you dolling it up a bit? Yeah. Lie to us for a while.
So it's quite funny to watch the internet just flip out.
I hadn't really been... keeping up with, like, noticing a trend that you announce a game and you open pre-orders at the same time. Like, you can pre-order Fallout 4 right now. Like, buy it on Amazon.
A few years ago.
It's sort of, like, it's one of the best-selling games on Steam right now. it's just nothing. There's one trailer that doesn't say...
Yeah, it's been up a few years now.
About what's going on.
People do it, though, because they get excited.
Yeah. But it, with the Witcher downgrade thing, you pointed out to me, Tom, that... there is a certain legitimacy in being upset about that if you pre-ordered because of the trailer that does not look like the final thing.
Yeah.
That's one case where it does seem...
It hurts people who aren't reading game news every day. Like, if you're just casually interested in games and you see that trailer at E3 and you go, oh, that looks awesome, I'm going to pre-order. But then you don't follow any gaming coverage for 3 years. Because anyone who'd read or seen any Witcher screenshots in the last year or two would know that it's not going to look like that. It's obviously going to have a downgrade. But, you know, a lot of people just don't have time or the inclination to follow games that closely. And those people are really hurt by that kind of...
Yeah, but those people aren't even going to know it's happened, I suspect. Like, the only people who will identify this as a problem are the people who probably should know better.
Yeah, I think... I mean...
These days, they can just get a refund.
Yeah, it's true,
so upsetting.
E3 is so transparently, like, just a carnival of marketing and... lies. you know, it just feels like it's obvious to everyone that, you know, the division is not going to look how the division was shown like a year or two ago when they showed that incredible, like, you know, a guy taking cover on a police car and all the glass shattering and full physics on everything and the way that the animation procedurally closes the door as he's moving past it. Game just can't do that.
Or that little hand nudge on the door thing will just keep triggering at really inappropriate times. In Assassin's Creed, you know, if you walk past someone like, I think it might have been introduced in Assassin's Creed 2, ATO put his hand slightly on them to kind of slightly nudge them out of the way.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
It just does it all the fucking time, when it's totally inappropriate.
Yeah.
Stroking crowds as he passes through, like corn in a wheat field.
I feel like every innovation we've had to make movement more fluid and convincing in a 3D environment has also backfired and still hasn't been fixed. Like, putting one leg up slightly up, if like one of your feet is on a hot raised surface and the other one isn't, that constantly mistriggers or glitches out so that you keep putting it up and down and up and down and up and down.
Do you think Fallout 3 was that one of the... No, actually, no, that's right. Sorry, I'm talking rubbish. It was actually, it was GTA that had, because it was, the, was it Euphoria?
Euphoria.
That introduced that? That was like a...
Yeah, that's cool.
A revelation, because I remember it not being the case in Fallout 3. Is that right? That it was...
Yeah.
You'd have one leg floating on a...
Yeah, and in GTA, their legs adapt to the slope of the surface, and so you can see a man on a rocking boat, and his legs will be adjusting to kind of keep him.
Oh yeah,
it still looks a bit unnatural, but it's much, much better than the stiff, bolt upright game engine thing.
I've had I've looked at that animation a lot of you standing on a boat in GTA 4 whilst it rocks, because I found if I did stand on a boat in GTA 4 while it rocks, the police would. Run up to the edge of the lake, it's a lake in Central Park, and they would get to the end of the pier and like aim at me for a while and then just run off the pier and fall in the water and then just swim back to the coast and then do it all again and they just do it on a constant loop without ever firing or doing Was there any other news?
Probably, but nothing of consequence.
No, I guess.
All the news will happen next week.
Yeah.
E3 happens and everyone in the games press dies.
What have you folks been playing?
I've been playing Her Story, which is not out for another couple of weeks, and I certainly won't spoil any of the story because that's the entire goal of it. But it's a fantastic narrative game in which...
Tell us about her gameplay.
Her gameplay is... So you play a person sitting in front of an old CRT monitor that's an old police database.
I can totally relate to this.
And it's quite nicely realised. Like, you can see the reflections of fluorescent lights kind of on the curving of the screen, so it's got that kind of... that idea going on. And occasionally, police car goes past you, you'll see the red and blue lights reflecting off the screen, so it's kind of a facsimile of, like, actually looking at an old CRT monitor. And this... Always like deliberately shitty interface that gives you access to a massive library of video clips, and all of the video clips are of a woman being interviewed by police. And your job, the way you play the game, is to search this database. And any search time you put in, it will only ever return 5 results, even if the search time is applicable to 20 or 15. So you have to be like increasingly precise with your queries, and some of the clips are just her being kind of funny or silly in the middle of an interview, and some of them are her telling her story, like being interviewed by the police for someone's gone missing. You don't know why. So obviously, the first term it gives you that's pre-typed into the interface is murder, in all caps. And that brings up, like, I don't know, 11 or 12 results, of which you can only access 5 at that point. And then one by one you watch them and you gain more ideas for things to search for. So maybe the name of the guy, so you type in the name and that'll give you more clips, and you're always aware that there are actually more clips still to be discovered beyond the ones that you're being shown. And bit by bit, you piece together this this story, and it creates moments of revelation that are akin to watching a brilliant whodunit. Like it creates amazing like twist moments that are all the more powerful for having some authorship in them.
Right.
So the whole idea of the game is that the game is written, like the story is written there in front of you. But the structure is yours. Like, you create the structure.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And it's so clever. And it's such a simple idea. And it's so satisfying just to puzzle it out. So I had it open in one window. And on my second monitor, I had a Word document. And just relentlessly taking notes. I was like, oh, so they were there at this location and this time. That must mean this. And like, there's a time and date at the top right of all the videos. Someone was like making notes about the time and the date she's been interviewed and how that might relate to the story and that kind of thing. And it's really, really good. And it's impressive.
Do you have a specific question you are tasked with solving?
No, it's just you don't know who you are in the game.
It's just, who am I?
Yeah, but you know, all of this is to be discovered, you know. And it's purely through a pretty good acting performance from the woman. It's just the same actor for the entire thing, doing quite good, good job, and your opinion of her changes. It almost goes backwards and forwards all the time, but depending on what you're watching. And it's a good dark, twisty story that you're gradually piecing together. Huh. And I won't say more or anything more specific than that, because the joy of it is putting it together. And it's going to be like $5 or $6, which is like pocket change. And it took me about 2 to 3 hours to actually kind of get the bones of the skeleton of the story together. But then if you want to like completely max out, you can look at the database at any time, so you get to see how many of the video clips you've watched and how many are left to be discovered. And if you want to max it out, it's going to take a lot longer.
Do they have like specific titles, video clips? How do you know which ones you've seen?
So all of the dialogue in all of the clips is transcribed, and if the word you type is in the transcription, it will appear in the feed.
Right.
So there is some scope to abuse it and just type random words and maybe get lucky and unlock a major plot point earlier than perhaps it would be satisfying to. And I think one of the interesting things about this is that because the plot beats are like dictated by your own intuition, really, I wonder if it will be a satisfying story for everyone if you don't fall into the rhythms that I happen to encounter going through that library. But Andy Kelly reviewed it for us, and he loved it. And we both got an amazing experience out of it. I think a lot of the intuitive queries you do lead you down a certain path that is quite satisfying. But it'd be
that's
really interesting.
Awesome. How different was your playthrough from Andy's?
I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet because we're in a big open plan office. And
yes,
now we're all like, you know, we've basically been evangelizing about this, and now everyone wants to play it. So I'll literally have to lock Andy in the toilet or something and just like go through it.
Like Game of Thrones. Cares about that. Like, Game of Thrones is all over Twitter.
Oh,
basically.
Yeah.
So,
but you know, fuck Twitter.
Yeah. I've been playing a board game, which is not really a board game, with Matt Castle, the editor of AXM, which sounds very, very similar. I was thinking that I'd quite like to rip it off for a game project. But Sherlock Holmes Consulting Detective, in which you're presented with, you get it like a book. Did we play this, Tom?
No, I want to play it.
Maybe we should play a game of this after the podcast ends.
Yeah, sweet.
But you're presented with a kind of like a story, essentially. You just open, and Holmes is being told what the crime is, basically. And you have a map, and you have a newspaper of the day's events, and you have this directory of locations that you can go to, which is huge. Like, it's just got every location in London, but only some of them will be relevant to the particular case you're doing. So you kind of think, well, maybe we'll go to the coroner's office, and you look up where the coroner's office is. Then you look into the kind of the storybook that you've been given, you flip to the right page, and it gives you a narrative account of what happens when you get there. And you slowly piece together, using these kind of interviews that you do in each of these locations, the nature of the crime. But your actual ability to piece together the crime is dependent on your intuitive leaps and the kind of deductions you make. Not intuition. Holmes doesn't work with intuition. And it's brilliant when it works. It does have similar problems in that you can sometimes make intuitive leaps which get you to a plot point which you should not have really naturally discovered. Because the thing is, in a game, it can handle this stuff much more fluidly, I imagine, but when you're dealing with like a book and you're going to an entry, they can't write multiple entries based on your knowledge state. So it's just like, I asked the magistrate about the cigarette case, and you're like, what fucking cigarette case?
It helps here that the clips are very short, so between like 5 and 10 seconds, if that. So it's just like a few sentences of your exchanges, and that really lets them. That really helps with that. So it's rare that you're going to hear a statement in one video that's going to spoil more than one thing for you, one element of the story. So that's going to help it, and I think it's. There's nothing else like it I've played or encountered. Though, Marsh, the kind of mental process you describe of having, clicking things together in your head is unique to interactive entertainment. And it's one of the reasons why I think her story is a little bit of a narrative landmark, because it enables that so well by just giving you a search bar and letting you just you express yourself, your thoughts and your intentions just through that simple mechanism. And
it must feel like a little validation of your theory every time it actually pops up, you know, because it's that thing that you thought she might have mentioned, she did mention.
And then
I love how the restrictions of your interaction with that system are also kind of coded into the narrative, you know?
Yeah, for sure. It's the kind of, it's a little bit contrived in that it's an ancient PC database, so that's the reason it can only return a certain number of things. But it's fine, you get past that, like, it's not a sticking point.
iOS App Store can only display one result per page. It's quite futuristic for that.
Yeah. So I really, really recommend, especially for the price. It's just...
So how many, the clips are only 5 to 10 seconds, how many of them are there?
Oh gosh.
Hundreds?
I think there's more than 100, at a guess.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's interesting. That's much more, when you first described it, I was imagining like 5 minute clips, so I was thinking it'd be sort of getting a rough topic and then watching a long video.
Most of them are very short. A few are a little longer, perhaps 30 seconds, but they're relatively unusual. It's just a few. And you don't hear the questions asked that are asked to her, so you just hear her responses, which is also really interesting. Yeah,
it sounds great.
Yeah, really, I really, really, really enjoyed it. Yeah.
So there's not much about it that I didn't know before you started talking about it, but just that description of how you interface with it and the fact that it becomes, you know, driven by your own intuition and that makes it so much more interesting to me.
I think that, so the initial search that you're not forced to do, you can delete the word murder and type whatever you want in.
That's the kind of player I am. Like, bananas!
I want to hear about eggs.
Peace! What about peace? So you almost... Your knowledge unlocks the clips that are missing. So you're being shown 5 of 10, then you access the other 5 by just knowing things about the story. So it's really cleverly gated, I think. But it remains to be seen how well gated it is in terms of, like, once you expose it to a crowd, do people just, like, solve it within half an hour and feel cheated or whatever? Mm. Get a Steam refund.
Is there... How do you... It's going to be difficult to answer without spoiling it. But how do you know when you finish? Because it sounds like there's... It sounds like you go through a series of revelations which change your opinion on what happened. But how do you know that your current opinion is the final one? Mm. That there isn't more revelations to be found?
You reach a point where you've kind of got the story down from start to finish. But I kept on going because I really wanted to know more precise details about, you know, what happened. And there is a point where, like, after a while, equivalent of MSN Messenger thing pops up and a mysterious person contacts you and says, are you finished yet? You can type yes or no. That's all you can type, yes or no. If you type yes, then it goes to the ending. If you type no, you carry on investigating. That's not really a spoiler to say. It doesn't mean things, but that's how it's paced.
Hmm.
Very good.
Cool.
Very good.
Awesome. When's it out?
24th of this month, June, I believe.
Cool.
What have you been
playing? Since you asked at the same time, I've been playing Overland, which is also one released, and I don't know when this one's going to be out, but it's a game by Adam Saltzman and Shay Pierce. Adam Saltzman did Cannibalt, and Shay Pierce actually worked on Hearthstone for a long time, and then joined Zynga, and he's the guy who left Zynga when... No, wait. Who did he join? Someone else. And then Zynga bought them, and he's the one who left when Zynga bought them. So he actually never worked for Zynga. That was a lie. anyway, it's like sort of XCOM strategy, but super simplified in a post-apocalypse that's about just kind of scavenging and staying alive. And every map that you play is a very, very small grid, only about like maybe 8x8 squares. And it's beautifully presented as if it's a kind of sort of resin diorama, kind of like a beautifully hand sculpted model or something. And it's, the tiles are big enough that a car fits onto one tile. And each of your people only has 2 movement points. So you can move 2 squares. So that's kind of how, I'm not sure what the word for it is, like low res or, not literally in display resolution, but in terms of the, like, granularity of the board. And despite that, it's quite, hardcore. Like, you start with one person, and the first level is randomized, but the first level is always has the same ingredients, which is, there's one other person there with you who is not on your team yet. There's a car behind a steel gate, and the first thing you do is always walk up to that person and invite them to your team. And then there's 2 of you, and then you open the gate, and as soon as you open the gate, it makes a massive creaking noise, and that summons aliens or things from underneath the ground. So the idea is there's all these like insectoid alien-y things buried under the ground everywhere, and anytime you make noise, you summon more of them. And they don't arrive immediately, you just kind of see some like burrowing marks, and then like I think next turn or maybe two turns time they pop up and then they start chasing you. And you have no weapons when it starts, and no way of attacking the aliens in any way. All you can do is get in the car and drive off. Once you're in the car, you can, if one of them's in front of you, you can drive into the alien, but that will hurt them, but it'll also damage your car, and I think your car can only take like two hits and then it's destroyed forever. And once you have no car, it's a fucking nightmare. So you want to keep the car. You don't really want to bash it into aliens if you can. And that first level is always pretty easy, unless you purposefully hang around for a long time. You'll be fine. And then you get in the car and drive off. And then as soon as you leave that 8x8 map, you go to a kind of road screen, where it's just one long road with lots of little detours off the side of it. And I think your objective is just to get to the other end of the road. Although at the end of it, there's just a big stop sign, so I don't know, like, well, why do I want to get to there? Maybe you don't. But the idea is, on those little 8x8 maps, you're scavenging things like fuel and sticks, which are the best weapons I've found so far. Oh no, I did find a shiv, actually. But that's the kind of weaponry we're getting into. And, fuel cans, and then you'll have, like, if you scavenge a bit on that first map, you'll maybe have, like, 10 fuel. And then those detours will all have a different fuel cost. Each one has like a difficulty rating and a fuel cost. Like, it'll either be red, green, or yellow, depending on how high the alien threat is there. And then, fuel cost of like 8 fuel or 10 fuel. And it's kind of balanced so that you either need to go to a fuel station or you need to go to someone that's pretty close. And often the closest places are the most dangerous ones. And if you go to a dangerous place and you haven't got any weapons yet, then you're kind of screwed because there's just so many aliens and, they're already unburrowed when you get there, and you can't do anything about them. But the ones that are further away obviously cost more fuel, and I haven't... So I only played it for, like, maybe an hour, maybe less. And it's very kind of roguelike-y in that you, once your team is dead, you just start again completely from the beginning. And... it's very difficult right now. This is a very unfinished build, and apparently even the current build they're working on has like a completely redesigned UE from what I played. But it's a really weird mix of... those guys are very good at making incredibly simple, beautiful, like very accessible games. And this is that. It has everything's broken down to very simple choices and very simple actions, and... all of the buttons to do those actions are really big and clear, and they show you exactly what you're going to do. It's kind of, in a lot of ways, the polar opposite of Invisible Ink, where Invisible Ink has loads of complexity and stuff to it, but you're going to have to really sit there and figure out do the orange buttons cost action points, and do the yellow buttons not cost action points, and that peak button that's displaying next to the door, does it mean that door, or does it mean around the corner from the door? All that kind of ambiguity is gone. And I think, like, really... with surprisingly little cost to the sort of range of interesting choices. Like, it doesn't dumb down the range of things you can do. And in fact, it gives you more options than something like XCOM, because although you don't have guns so far, if you have a fuel tank and you're standing next to a car, you have about 7 different things you can do with a fuel tank. You can pour all the fuel into the car, fill it up. You can... siphon fuel out of the car and put it into the fuel tank. You can pour fuel on the ground, and if there's already fuel on the ground, you can light it, or you can put the fuel can down, or you can pick it up, if there's one on the ground. And if there's another character standing next to you, one of your options will be to swap places with them. And then if you're in a car and you pull up next to someone, even if they have no action points left, you get the option to pull them in. So there's all kinds of little tweaks like that where you kind of, even if someone else is out of action points, you can kind of do something to them that enables you to manipulate your people. And so even on that first level, which is always the same, there's always a car and a gate and one person, it usually takes me like 3 turns to get the person, scavenge some stuff, open the gate, get in the car and drive away. And one time I did it in 2 turns because I realized, oh, if that guy's run out of action points, then it doesn't matter as long as this guy gets to the car on this turn, because once he's in the car, he can drive really fast. And then once he's, if he just pulls up alongside the other guy, then he can pull him in, even though he's out of action points, and then we can just drive off this turn. And so there's those little satisfying things like that. And almost all of the things in the environment, like there's sort of dumpsters that you can search and old ruined cars and rocks and things, almost all of those can be pushed. So you can do things like, you know, push a boulder and then a skip together to create a barrier and then set light to the only way through that barrier so the aliens catch light.
It's kind of like quite a simulation.
Yeah. Yeah, very much, I think, inspired by those kinds of games. But all of that complicated, interesting stuff has not yet come into play for me because I just get fucking killed no matter what I do. I just get slaughtered. It's brutally difficult, and it feels like right now, my only kind of complaint about it, they asked me for feedback, so I sent them lots of positives, which were mostly the things I just said. And the only negative I had to say was basically that I felt like, I mean, A, very, very difficult, but B, a sort of the kind of difficult where I don't know what I should have done instead. It's like, if you try and run away from the monsters, you get cornered by the monsters because there's too many of them. And then, well, I can't attack them because I don't have any weapons. So let's go to an equipment place and get some weapons. And the weapons will be like two broken twigs. And to get to them, I have to get past three more monsters. And then when I've got the twig, I hit the monster. And then the twig loses one of its only two hit points. And the sound of me hitting him summons three more monsters. And I'm just like, I don't know then! What should I do? Like one time, my earlier games, it was always like more interesting things happened in the first couple of times I played it, when I completely fucked up really quickly, just because I fucked up in so many interesting and varied ways. Like, I accidentally backed my car over the other person I was trying to pick up, so that they were knocked onto the ground. And then, an enemy
attack. That
never
happens in XCOM, you know what I mean? Land your fucking dropship on one of your own crew.
And then an alien came up to me, but it was, because it's a very early version, one of the aliens is just like a square white box with no features at all, and so I didn't know it was an enemy until
terrifying.
Until it actually attacked me. And then it was right next to me, and I had no weapons, so I couldn't attack it, because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing. So I poured fuel on the ground, and then set light to the fuel, and it did damage the alien, but then it also set fire to my incapacitated friend I just ran over. Well, I'm really not helping you, am I? There's also, the other thing I really like about it is that there's other scavengers around, and that first one you meet always comes with you, and so you have a team of two at least. But then in future, it's, I think, random whether they want to come with you or not. So you go to a place to scavenge fuel, and you find someone else is scavenging fuel, and I ran over to him like, yeah, join my team. And he's like, no thanks, I'm just looking for fuel.
Are any of them ever hostile?
Well, no, but they're, well, not so far. But they are, that guy's scavenging fuel, and he really does walk around picking up all the fuel on the map. And that's what I'm trying to do. So there's only so many canisters. So it's a very awkward tension of like, I'm probably not going to kill you, but if there's an alien coming for you, I'm not going to save you. And that's, you only really find that out if you move up to them. And so after the first time I encountered one who didn't want to join me, I got into another situation where I was scavenging for equipment, I think. And there was one person who was like, already there, and he was injured and kind of had a lot of aliens on him, and I didn't know if he wanted to come with us or not, so we kind of scavenged what we could and then got back in the car, and then I could have left then and there, but I sort of stopped my turn halfway to the edge of the map so that we'd be quite close to him, like not close enough to talk, but just if he wanted to come over he could, and he did come over and he wanted to join, so we yanked him into the car and drove off.
That sounds like a really good plan for him. Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it's really interesting that there's kind of that idea that there are other people and they're not necessarily hostile, but they just might not want to join you. They just don't particularly care.
You can get a dog, right?
I haven't seen one.
I've seen this in screenshots on Twitter.
Quite possible.
Can't have an apocalypse without a dog. That's the law according to the Fallout 4 trailer.
But yeah, I haven't got that far.
Is it how early is it, do you think? Like,
I don't know. I've been working on it quite a while, I think. Heather Penn is the artist, I was trying to remember.
It looks fucking amazing.
Yeah, it's really,
really gorgeous, yeah.
And it's quite, I think it's going to be coming out on like mobile as well, and it's quite mobile friendly, it sort of feels that way, like, because everything's so big and so...
Not that many squares on a single screen.
But like I say, I don't think it really suffers from it. I think a lot of the simplifications are actually quite welcome. Like if you ever get tired of moving your six guys in XCOM across their 14 different action points they each have, then this is a game you'll appreciate.
just before the podcast started, Adam Saltzman tweeted how excited he was about Mirror's Edge 2 and said that his level of excitement prior to Mirror's Edge 1, followed by his disappointment at Mirror's Edge 1, was the thing that inspired Cannibal. So I think maybe if Mirror's Edge 2 doesn't go so well, we can have Cannibal Catalyst at some point.
Awesome.
Excellent.
That sounds really good, though. I want to play that. I wanted to play it since I've seen it pop up in my Twitter feed, actually, simply because it looks amazing. I didn't know what kind of game it was, actually. Surprised that it's... because I had no... I couldn't work out how it would work with so few grid squares if it was a tactical game.
Yeah, they just pack a lot of options into those squares. Just every situation you're in, any of the things you might want to do, they make sure there's an option for that.
What,
if anything, have you been playing?
Well, I don't know whether it's a point. I wrote my column on RPS about a game called Gynophobia this week. Is it gyno or gynophobia? I don't know actually how you pronounce that.
Oh, it's gynecologist, isn't
it? Yeah, it's gynecologist, so yeah, it must be gynophobia. Which is a game that's on early access that is really bad. It's under 2 hours long. And there's almost really no point me describing the game whatsoever because it's just poor. I suppose the reason I wrote about it partly because I played a bunch of other stuff that I didn't like as well for the column, and I had to at some point hand in some copy. So I decided to write about that. But also because it occurred to me that, like, there's been a discussion obviously about the refund policy, and a lot of people, indie developers of some standing feel that they have some fears about whether their games, people will be able to breeze through their games and demand refunds. I kind of think that they're not the ones who are totally at risk here. The people who are really at risk are the people who make bad games of under 2 hours. And it made me think about what exactly the value is of a bad game. Because this Gynophobia costs £2.40 or something like that. I can't remember exactly how much. The price of a coffee, you know. And, I think I'd prefer to have a coffee. But like at a certain point, like the refund policy that Steam now has, I mean, it used to be that obviously there is some threshold of quality below which you would not willingly pay anything, right? Mm. But it seems like that threshold has been pushed up probably by the refund policy. I was thinking as kind of abhorrent as that game is in a lot of ways, Do I feel it's just that the people could play it and then just say, no, I'm having my money back now? Because that's not the experience I get from going to see a bad film or, you know, reading a bad book.
I wonder, it could be, in some ways, a good antidote to this. Have you noticed the phenomenon of people sort of trying to justify their purchases? Like, the more they've invested, the more zealously they'll defend the thing that even when the flaws are kind of inescapable, just say, oh, I don't mind that, that's just like... I guess that tends to happen.
Dota players, Tom.
Well, I was actually thinking of like console wars. I guess that really comes down to the $200 to $300 purchase that you made, rather than the $5 Steam sale game you got. Mm. But yeah, like now, I mean, I haven't been thinking these terms myself, but presumably people are now, when they play the first 2 hours of the game, in their heads having a mental clock of like, okay, if by the 2 hour mark I don't feel like I'm really into this. Like, I wonder if it could almost hurt the game to be thinking all the time, are we really having fun yet, though? Is this really... Did I get my money's worth? I mean, that was $10. Do I really want to leave that $10, you know, on the table, or do I want to take it back? But I don't think that'll be... I don't know. In general, I'm in favour of people getting their money back for things they didn't like.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a bad policy from Valve. I think it's good for customers. I think there's a kind of irreconcilable problem of attributing value to things that aren't very good. And
it's low value.
Yeah, but it does mean that, you know, like, I don't know what the situation of the guy who made this game, or guys who made the game, I assume they're all guys, who made the game, are, but I'd imagine that they're not hardened veterans of the game development scene. And like, it seems that people trying to make their first foray into making a commercial game, albeit very bad, don't have a place on Steam. Although they could distribute their game on Steam, I guess, but they wouldn't be able to make money from it. And I don't know if that's a good or a bad thing. I don't know if it matters that Steam isn't the place for that stuff. Certainly make my life doing this column on early access games a lot fucking easier if there's less shite that I have to play each week.
Yeah, and I think that's what Valve want, although they do want to open the floodgates at some point. I don't think they want it to... They do care about the casual browser clicking on something and not having a horrible experience. So they have a horrible experience that's bad for Valve, and they don't want that to happen. So they're not looking to get to a situation where everyone can succeed. And it's often... It's interesting talking to them behind the scenes and talking about the developers, because there are... I'm reading between the lines a lot, but I feel like some developers have worked with other platform holders before and are used to the arrangement where a platform holder wants the developer to do well no matter what. And Valve sometimes have to sort of remind people that, like, it isn't our objective to make all developers as successful as possible.
Yeah,
making something bad, we don't necessarily want you to succeed. Mm-hmm. And some of the changes, I think the discovery update, some people were complaining, some very successful people were complaining about their sales going down, Valve said something to the effect of, like, well, the objective of that update wasn't necessarily to make all the most successful people more successful. It was, you know, to make sure people who haven't had a run of successful games already have different priorities and different needs to people who do.
Isn't the refund thing about bringing Steam in line with local policies worldwide?
It's a European policy, I believe, in lots of countries. To have mandated refunds after a certain amount of time.
So it's a requirement, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you...
Well, apparently not. Because it's got to be in jail.
That's true.
I mean, it can't be... I don't think they've done it because the court has ordered them to do it. And the thing, like, they could easily have just enabled it for Europe, but it's very telling and interesting that they've... It's a complete mandatory thing for everything.
Well, and I do think that they're using it to change the culture of the games that they get on there.
Yeah, and I think the buyer confidence thing is going to be... Do you see the graph on Steam Spy of the total purchases on Steam? Like, since this thing was announced, the number of paid Steam... Like, it's phrased weirdly because they don't really... They can't track purchases from this external thing, Steam Spy. They only track how many people own games. And so it's... number of owners of games that cost money, and it really steeply climbs after the refund announcement. So the total number of games Steam is selling is going up because of this, seemingly. And yeah, I think that's their objective, is because if it's not universal, if it's, you know, some, because the easy thing to do is to leave it completely up to the developer, which that wasn't what they did before they, it was still up to Steam, but they said you just couldn't have a refund, and then in secret, they were actually giving refunds, but they just wouldn't admit to giving refunds because, I don't know. But, yeah, the reason they changed that policy wasn't just, well, let's leave it to the developers whether to give a refund, is that they want customers to feel like, to not have to think about that, to not have to research whether the person they're buying from is going to have a good refund policy or not. They want it to be blanket across the entire thing so that people can just buy things. It can just become a habit to, oh, I'm interested in that, I'll buy it and try it out. It's kind of, a little bit like, you know, a 2-hour free demo for everything.
There have been a few kind of headlines on various sites. I think we've done one or two. Jim Sterling has picked out a few of games that are just so abysmal. Like, games have gone up to a certain standard now that has slipped back since early access happened. Like, it's very rare. Like, I think the reason why a lot of the kind of the scoring processes of websites and reviewers have become so squashed into the upper end is that games used to just not function. And the review scales were based around games that just, oh, well, this just doesn't work, so we've got to have space in the review scale to say how broken it is. And that's still in place. For a while, it's just that everything would get, like, 60 or 70 plus because it's not fundamentally broken. Early access has brung that back.
quite gratifying in a lot of ways, because I always think that when, like, we'd get flack on PC Gamer for getting things, you know, within that score range. We didn't, we used the whole scale, but it was rare to give something 30% or 20%. And that was because most stuff wasn't shit. Like, most stuff was, even the things that you think, oh, that's total bullshit, you haven't actually played it. And as the reviewer, when you have played it, and you find it to be basically competent and quite enjoyable, if once you get past a few flaws, that's a good thing. That's not 20%, that's not 30%. It might be still, like, you know, don't buy it unless you have some particular interest in this particular thing. But
now,
I feel like people didn't have an idea of, like, what it would be like to be an actually shit game. Finally! Yeah. You see what we were... This is the missing link between...
Yeah, we finally get to see what a 30, the public, general public, gets a sniff.
A Lucy of crapness.
Gets a sniff of what a 30% game is like, and Valve have swept in and gone, okay, you can have your money back if you get like a thing that is 30, just fucking bin it and just get out of there.
Well, that's the difference between gynophobia and I think the things that Valve policy is really meant to target is that, like, early access, because of the availability of things like the Unity Asset Store, which means people can purchase quite professional-looking assets for their game and then just fill, like, a shitty height map piece of terrain with their expensively purchased assets. Well, cheaply purchased assets, actually. And fool people in screenshots into thinking that there's some kind of process of game development going there that they will buy into and, you know, oh, it's going to become an MMO. Mm. And, you know, it's going to become a survival thing with fucking mountable dinosaurs, which is every game's
every
ambition.
Every game is that,
That's the problem with early access is there's loads of that stuff on there, stuff which is just made by not people who I think are naturally swindlers, but fantasists, you know, people who just don't really understand their own capabilities. And gynophobia isn't that. It's a complete, I mean, it is made with Unity assets, but it's a complete thing. It's rubbish in every single way, really. But I mean, it's completely
rubbish.
But, you know, they're not swindling anybody. They've not made any promises about the future of it. It's just a thing, self-contained, and it's not very good. And I feel like, but I even feel like that should have some kind of dollar value attached to it if the developers want to. And it does seem like that's just like a price tag you can just peel back off now. But I don't know if I won't really shed that many tears if it disappears forever.
What was the game that they recently did a sort of renewed promotional campaign for it, but it first came out over a year ago, and their promotional campaign now is a year ago we released one of the worst games of all time.
Oh yeah, I got that email.
It was like a
dinosaur world thing.
Ark, was it?
No.
There's a different one, and...
What is it? Many other ones.
Which also looks shite, actually. Yeah. I've seen a recent video of Ark, and it looks fucking hilarious and bad. But,
this one, I think it was, like, sci-fi, and it had... I think it did have dinosaurs in it, and also aliens, and I think it had, like, multiple planets and spaceships and stuff, but also, like, first-person shooter, open world, massively multiplayer, just everything, wild ambitious. And it got panned critically. I don't remember it at all, but apparently it got panned critically. And they relaunched it. And basically they said, like, a year ago we released this terrible game and we could have just given up, but instead we just worked on it again, like, constantly ever since. And now here are some of our user reviews, and it was just a bunch of, like, commenters just saying, this is incredible, I can't believe this game is this good. And like,
it does look pretty cool, actually, in that video that came with that press release.
And it's $1 now.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That was their relaunch thing. Was basically, like, A, we fixed all this shit, and B, it's $1. So,
aww, it's quite sweet. Yeah.
But what about all those people who spent $10 or $15 in the initial launch?
Hopefully, they're still getting the thing they wanted if they have indeed fixed all these things. Hmm.
They've all died of sadness now.
That's why they're going to refund them, or they die of sadness.
There was something like when the trailer started, I was really like, oh god, because they were sort of bragging about having released one of the worst games, and yeah, like you say, like for the people who spent money on it, that's not such a funny thing.
Yeah. I don't know, you get a lot of emails from people desperately trying to find a reason you should cover their game, and like the prevailing wisdom now amongst people who try to instruct indie developers about how to sell their game to the press is that you've got to find a narrative, you've got to find a story, which isn't really true. You've just got to make a good game. But failing that, then the story is useful. And actually, I was like, yeah, fair play to these guys. It's quite a good story, really. Making the worst game of all time, and then actually just making a decent one on its bones.
It's an unusual pitch, but. We didn't do it. Oh. It's just like, things were game sold now. How good is this? Like, I don't know, there's an element of where if you're going to host a game on your website, which millions of people are going to read, there's an element of advocacy there in simply featuring that over the many, many, you know, hundreds of games.
Well, that's the main problem. I mean, when I read these advice pieces about how to sell your indie game, I think a lot of them, they seem to assume that there's a justness in your game getting coverage, and like there's just lots of fucking games out there.
Yeah,
you know, that's the thing. And however good it is, it's not necessarily going to be the thing that you cover just because there's lots.
Mm.
And also the idea that you could write an article that would give advice to any indie developer that would enable them to get their game covered would completely undermine the concept of coverage. Yeah. The whole point of, that you serve as a journalist is to distinguish between the games that aren't good and the games that are good. And so if there was some advice you could use to bypass that, the pressure would just be irrelevant. Shall we do questions?
Let's do some motherfucking questions. I am the question lord. Dan writes in with a really long email, which I'm going to synopsize, but he begins, "Dear Gun Gamer Rockpoint, esteemed gentle persons," he says, also giving two introductions. So he's talking about The Witcher 3. He says, "It looks like a great RPG set in an interesting world with a rather controversial backstory. The controversy, if present, is in... some would say it's entirely characteristic historical portrayal of gender and racial dynamics and their use for dramatic purposes without apparent comment on their acceptability in the alleged real world." I assume he means in the fictional world? Or by implication the real world as a result of their lack of comment in the fictional world. Anyway, he goes on to say, "I feel creators should be entitled to use whatever setting they like in their pursuit of art, and by no means should any creator be censored by the cultural mores of their time, dot, dot, dot. However, I simultaneously feel that to an extent, a creator chooses to set a story in a world where certain cultures, ethnicities, or genders are, for want of a better word, oppressed, is effectively taking a position on that setting. In the case of The Witcher, I feel CD Projekt Red are stating not that they feel this culture is acceptable or right, but they don't wish to take a view on the rightness or wrongness of those elements in the game." Lots more things he says, which I'm not reading out. Then he says, "I have no problem with contextual nudity, violence, or stories which are set against a dark backdrop, because people. But I do feel that gratuitous use of the same cliches as a purely narrative vehicle is rather weak, and to me, a disappointing position. What do you think? Do you feel that creators in whatever medium have any sort of responsibility to express a viewpoint when setting a story in a controversial setting?" There are many, many, many more questions. He says, "Thanks at excessive length, yes. Yours, Dan."
I always think of it in terms of any fictional thing I'm watching. I always think, you chose to fantasize about this. So if it's something dark, if it's something horrible, or if it's something unjust or unfair, you probably should be saying something about it. And if you're going to show something dark and unjust and unfair without saying something about it, then it's just weird that you chose to fantasize about that particular thing. Like, I really want to spend my time thinking about and imagining this one thing again and again without ever commenting or reflecting on it. This is not about The Witcher. I haven't played enough of that to comment. But things like, so in, particularly in sort of lesser films and TV when there's gratuitous rape scenes and then sort of there's just nothing about, it doesn't really comment on rape or sort of say anything about it that feels like it needed to be there in order to say this message, and not everything has to have a message, but if you're going to do super, really horribly disturbing and upsetting scenes, I feel like you should have some reason for doing them. And if you don't have a reason for doing them, you should ask yourself, why am I fantasizing about this again and again?
The thing with the Witcher 3 specifically is that it's trading on a very established and popular type of medieval RP, medieval fantasy. There's a genre that's...
European medievalism as well.
Yes. Yeah, precisely. It's like a kind of feudal European medieval fantasy, which is like has proven marketable value, if you see what I mean. So there's a good argument that says, why not create a fantasy world where all of these entrenched oppressions are undone, unravelled, and there are just like there are other oppressions, or you know, you've got this.
Complete well, it's more like world. The Elder Scrolls, right? I mean, there's lots of different races and things. That, I mean. There are also different human races in the Elder Scrolls. Obviously, there are also lizard men and cat people as well, but, you know.
Yeah, so close to the Elder Scrolls. But like, people, I think, when they criticise The Witcher and stuff, I think a lot of people want to go even further and just have just fantasies that are about new social systems that we haven't seen before. But the trouble is that they're not relatable on in a mainstream way that will appeal to them. So if you just have a world where like nothing is like the world you're in or the world you know or the history that you know, then how do you latch onto that and where do you get onto it? And I think the thing is about the medieval fantasy thing is that it's so repeated that there's a familiarity to it that among the general population that makes it marketable and makes it worth repeating for companies who are looking to set something somewhere and spend millions of dollars on a product.
It's the franchise of oppression.
Yeah, I mean...
A new game in the oppression franchise, awesome!
And there is a kind of... people do take a voyeuristic thrill in seeing scenes of violence and murder and, you know, everything else. I think the responsibilities, like, has to be attributed to the audience as well as the actual, the creators of the thing. Like, they're creating it knowing that there's an appetite for it. And there is a massive appetite for that kind of medieval fantasy with those oppressions. And that, I think that says more about the consumers and more about the society we live in that wants to consume that. But it actually does really about, you know, CD Projekt Red.
Yeah, well, you're not forced to cater to just those people, are you? There are other things that also can sell. It's not like, oh, hands are tied, people want this thing, so we've got to make this specific game.
Yeah,
I agree that there are disturbing trends in what people like to consume.
Definitely. Also, when it comes to fantasy, there's just such a narrow selection of things that have penetrated into the national consciousness. So you're looking at Lord of the Rings. Like,
yeah.
You're looking at the very narrow band of things. Like, I wish that Ian M. Banks' culture was, like, his vision of the culture was part of, like, this society that has no sense of, you know, possession because there is no scarcity anymore, and the kind of moral crisis that creates. That's really, really interesting. But that hasn't penetrated into the national consciousness. So if you're going to make a game and spend millions on it, you're not going to make a culture game because no one has any grasp on what that the culture means or what it is. You're going to make the fantasy thing that people will understand and know, oh, it's a, he's a knight and he goes around and he hits monsters and, oh, look, there's a woman and she's not wearing very much because, you know, that's how people were treated in that time. And, like, it just ticks all the boxes and is very familiar and very easy to market.
Yeah, it's a tricky thing. I don't know how you can extract certain kinds of oppression from any kind of fantasy culture which is set upon medieval ideologies. Because I remember reading a Twitter argument about saying somebody quite, you know, right on saying, but you know, you've got wizards. How is magic less believable than all these terrible things that you could just easily excise?
Mm.
And like, well, actually, no. Men being terrible to women is probably, like, if that didn't happen, that would be way more unbelievable to me than somebody being able to fire lightning at their fingers.
Yeah.
Because it's so, I mean, it's about humanity. You need to be able to relate to characters, and unless characters are horribly flawed in the way that humans are, then I think you've got a fundamental problem.
I think a lot of fantasy fiction also just takes existing biases in the culture we live in to extremes, for entertainment. Mm. So, because women are treated badly in our society, that's then replicated in extreme fashion in the fiction that we read. Because
yeah.
It's a way of examining it, even if it's just not an intelligent examination, just a way of reflecting it back. And that feels real to people because that is a recognisable part of our society that, you know, that there is domestic violence and there is, you know, that's repeated in more extreme ways than the fiction that we read.
I think The Elder Scrolls is a really interesting point of comparison because they, I mean, I don't know all of the quests in all of the games to sort of speak authoritatively on it, but there's a very interesting thread of multiculturalism in The Elder Scrolls, and it's, I imagine it came about through necessity because they wanted to give the player choice of who they want to be, and they either couldn't or didn't want to make the experience radically different depending on what race you chose or what gender you chose.
Mm.
And so Morrowind in particular is a really interesting one because that's set on an island of racist dark elves. And they are, it's this really isolated culture that is very kind of right-wing, and they specifically oppress Khajiit and Argonians. They call them the beast races because they're the less human ones. They're still humanoid. And they use them as slaves, but they've recently been kind of not quite conquered, but sort of semi-occupied by the Empire, who are the humans, who are kind of like styled after Romans, and they are obviously the most powerful faction in the world, and the Dark Elves can't really do anything about them. They can't really go against the Empire, but they've had this tradition of keeping slaves, and the Empire is against slavery, and so they're in this really awkward thing where, like, most of the rich people do still keep slaves because it's not really properly enforced and they can kind of get around it by sort of pretending they're employees.
Hmm.
And the Empire isn't really interested in clamping down on every single instance of it and doesn't want to cause fuss and, like, actually make it into a war. And so there's this uneasy tension between an oppressive culture and a sort of more open-minded one, although the Empire is pretty evil in its own way. Your role in that is that you just arrived on the island and you both have to be accepted by the Empire and just sort of in general, like in Oblivion, you get in all the Elder Scrolls games, you get to choose your race. And so in Oblivion, you're going to turn out to be like this person who the Emperor himself thinks is the savior of the world. And so it can't really be a world where, like, the Emperor would be totally racist against Argonians because the player might choose to be an Argonian, in which case, you're going to end up being that person. And same for gender, like he can't be a massive sexist. You can't, because they're not going to write a line where he's really surprised that the savior of the world turned out to be a woman. And then in Morrowind, you are going to be the savior of the world, as you always are, but they also wanted to do a thing where you're kind of an outsider, and you've just arrived on this island by boat, and it's, like I say, a very insular culture, mistrusting of outsiders. But it's not actually based on race. They are slavers and very right wing, but their prejudice isn't against non-dark elves, it's against outsiders. And so you can choose to be a dark elf in Morrowind, and it doesn't get you anywhere, because you're an outsider dark elf, and they can just tell that you're not from Vardenfell, and so you're just kind of like, you're almost worse to them than the other races. And so they do an oppressive culture that isn't relatable, it's not like any one that I know particularly. I mean, they're slavery, but it's not directly analogous, and they have very specific prejudices and very specific oppressions, and I thought it was way more interesting to have that in the context of an oppressive race who actually don't have all the power and are kind of powerless against an occupying force who could completely crush them if they wanted to, but who don't really want to cause that kind of fuss.
That's interesting. I'm not sure I encountered that, but like...
That's the shame, is like, because Morrowind, I really absorbed everything in it. I was just sort of obsessed with it for ages and played it to death. And then Oblivion and Skyrim, even more. I love both those games to death. But the actual fiction, I don't think the interestingness of the Elder Scrolls really came across in those.
I kind of feel those games feel like little kind of allegorical bubbles in the same way that individual Star Trek episodes do. And you're like, oh, so these guys with the funny foreheads, they're meant to be, that's analogous to, terrorists in an occupied country and, or freedom fighters, etc. But it never sustains itself as a reality on its own terms. I don't know.
Probably because it is so distant. But the thing is about Oblivion is that, and a lot of the main quests in Elder Scrolls games is that it's too bonkers. I don't care about Oblivion
cat
bits.
People.
Yeah.
although weirdly, so people with cat heads always seem pretty stupid to me. But then I was watching this TV series.
I saw.
Yeah, just in Twerton. I was watching a TV series about the medieval mind, and apparently dog-headed people were like a big thing back then. Like, loads of people just thought there were dog-headed people around. They were always in another place, the one you were in. Right. But it was a real crisis of religion, because people weren't sure whether they were descended from Adam and thus should be under God's rule. They were more like animals and thus you shouldn't preach Christianity to them. And there was a lot of debate about whether you should preach Christianity to the dog-headed people. And eventually they had these missions out to the east to visit the Mongols and Kublai Khan's palace and stuff. And when the Christians got there, they were like, so where are the dog heads? Where are the dog heads that you've got? And the Mongols, the best thing is that the Mongols were like, what? But also, they were like, I thought the dog-headed people live where you live. So it's just like this mass delusion of dog-headed people always living somewhere else.
That's amazing.
I don't remember why we got into that, sorry.
At least we can all agree that if the dog-headed people do exist, they should be our slaves.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's hard to get around the fact that, I mean, even fantasy, the reason that fantasy is ever believable is because it mimics things that were a reality in the minds of people in past civilizations. Whereas a lot of the stuff that occurs in the fantasy of the Elder Scrolls, for example, is not a fantasy that has ever occurred in the belief of the real world, in the way that people perceive the real world. Whereas, Arthurian fantasy and all these kind of things and Tolkien-esque fantasy, they're based on the myths that people believe to be true. And so they are kind of much more embedded in our culture, and they're much more easy for us to kind of accept and understand, and for dramas to be principled upon, I think.
Yeah, I actually wrote a piece about The Witcher 3's, on the use of the V word, which, the verisimilitude, which caused one of our listeners to rage quit the podcast because the word verisimilitude has been appropriated by certain elements of the internet.
Has it?
Yeah.
What's it meant? What do these idiots mean by when they say?
It's just kind of a way of justifying terrible rape scenes and stuff in things.
Oh, really?
As a verisimilitude, which is kind of what we're examining now.
Yeah, in Game of Thrones, I don't know. I think the difference you can see is when it's, you can always tell how things, these things should be judged on the way that they're framed, right? And it's very easy for you to tell in Game of Thrones when there is a lascivious aspect to the way that these events are framed. And that is more often the case, I would say, in the TV series, certainly. And probably in the books as well. But I don't think those events should be removed from the existence of those worlds, because I think it does decrease the reality of those fictions, the believability of those fictions.
It does.
They're predicated on human behaviours.
It does, and also it's very, very difficult for creators to comment on what's happening without putting their voice in a thing in a really obtrusive way that actually, again, breaks the fiction.
Yeah, I don't actually want fiction to be didactic either.
No, absolutely.
About stuff.
I mean, like, watching Game of Thrones, the horrible acts are committed, but the fact they're horrible is self-explanatory. You don't need the creators to come in and say, oh, look how awful that was, that was...
Well, they've gone out of their fucking way with some of the
Jesus,
characters.
Yeah,
it's like, oh, you didn't realise this guy was evil? Well, he's now a pedophile! And you're like, oh, shit, now I hate him, apart from all the killing he did before.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't know.
That's just writers pulling very quick levers to get things done.
Yeah, that, and that stuff is fucking abhorrent, I think.
Yeah.
And the fact that, oh, I can't say without using spoilers, but there's a sexualisation of certain characters in that, which I think exceeds the bounds with which they would be sexualizing them, or maybe it doesn't. I don't know.
No, well, like, a lot of characters are a lot younger in the books as well, is the other thing.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a different element.
But it's the way it's framed. You know, it's framed for entertainment, and I think that's the problematic part, really, rather than it being in the stories at all, or whether those events are commented on. I think you can present things completely at a distance, and for it to be dramatically necessary to the reality of those worlds, and yet not present them in a way which encourages people to slaver over them.
It's a fine line, but then the reason why, you know, maybe the reason why Game of Thrones is so successful is because it presents violence and sexual violence in a way that people enjoy.
Yeah.
And frankly, you know, polite society doesn't want to admit that, but maybe that is just a horrible truth. Consumer culture.
Wow, that's a grim conclusion of this podcast. Well, Quinn writes in to say, "Dear Creating Crowbar," and he talks about what I said on episode 94 about Life's a Strange, Interesting Art Style, which has very kind of weird speed paint scribbles on its textures. And he got to thinking about theatre, he says. The 20th century playwright Bertolt Brecht was famous for a technique he called... he gives a phonetic pronunciation of this one, which I'm going to try. Verfremdungseffekt, which I guess is German. Or distancing effect. This technique boils down to doing everything necessary to completely remove any sense of immersion the audience might feel, and leave them in no doubt that they are most definitely watching a play. This might include performing a scene transitions without bringing down the curtains or dimming the lights, or a man in the audience paid to loudly announce the scene number at the start of each scene. Which games do you think most interestingly deal with the concepts of immersion and self-awareness? Not in terms of quick fourth wall-breaking quips, but in terms of actual game mechanics and story elements. Keep on podding, says Quinn.
Well, the Magic Circle springs to mind, for sure.
Oh, yeah.
The whole thing is about the idea that you're in a game.
Yeah, I suppose that is kind of fourth wall-breaking stuff. I don't know. I suppose the thing is that games don't really need that much help in because I mean they have that apparatus of artificiality kind of inbuilt into them, into the fact that you have to access them via menus, there are loading screens, you know, there's moments when your interactivity is pulled away from you in cutscenes and all this stuff. You're constantly fighting against all that stuff to try and consume the I think we're quite good at it, really. I don't think it actually. I think Bertolt Brecht would be surprised at how resilient people are to his distancing effect.
Yeah, sure.
Like people just can fucking take it. They can take anything. They can take crashes to desktop.
I remember, I always love it when I walk through a game world, and let's say like it's a Battlefield Bad Company 2 map, and you're fighting in these houses, and you just sort of get over the fact that there is no furniture. It's just shooter level design. It's just walls, and you know the holes where the holes should be, perhaps windows just shouldn't be in those places. Like, windows are stupid places, but are great for a shooter if you want a certain sightline.
Yeah.
And you play it, and you just don't think about it at all until suddenly you actually look around and go, there are no chairs in this world. This is, I'm fighting for this town, and no one sits down. And the more you think about it, I was playing a terrible World War II assassin game where you play a real world.
Oh god, do you play the Irish?
Violet Assassin.
Yeah.
Oh, that one. Yeah. Okay, different one. I was thinking of the Saboteur, which is another terrible.
Yeah, no, it's the one Tom mentioned. And you go to
Velvet Assassin. The real person was called Violet Zava.
Yeah. You go to like these, kind of this underground bunker place. And I took a screenshot of it and tweeted it because I just came across like, a filing cabinet with a massive cabbage on it in the middle of this Nazi base, and I was like, it was the biggest cabbage I've ever. It's like the size of 5 human heads glued together. It's enormous cabbage, and I just stopped for a moment, and suddenly I think certain, like especially in terrible games where just a certain really terrible choice of, you know, room placement or item placement suddenly makes you realise that this is just all bullshit. This is total nonsense.
Well, that's one of my main irritations with Fallout 3 is actually that nobody's bothered to tidy up any of the places they're living. Like, you go to that radio station and it's just this derelict place with all these filing cabinets all over the floor, and like, it's been like multiple generations since these filing cabinets fell over and nobody thought
that they nobody were gonna... picked them up. Come on. Yeah.
You know, it's not a comfortable thing to sleep on, filing cabinet.
Steve Burns Video Gamer, did a video saying, I think it was like 7 reasons why Fallout is shit. And one of those reasons is that just no one's fucking tidied up.
Oh, really?
And it was exactly that point. And it is a great point. It's a really good point.
I stole that off an Xbox show, I should say.
Maybe he got it from Steve Burns.
Yeah. No, this is like his thing for ages.
Oh, right. This is the grand circle of games journalism eating itself. Isn't it?
Yeah, so I don't know whether we answered that or not, even.
What was the question?
Something about games breaking, dealing with concepts of immersion and self-awareness.
Oh, yeah, games.
But without, you know, without the kind of cheap fourth wall breaking quips.
A few games do it deliberately, like games are desperate to create that sense of immersion.
Any UI is exactly that distancing effect, isn't it, surely?
Yeah, even in Dead Space where they tried to move into the world, it's still just quite silly.
Simon writes in with a good story about Tom dying and there being poop everywhere. He says, "Dear sirs, I've been playing Pixel Pirates, a roguelike in which you build a ship and train a crew in various skills in order to clobber fellow sailors and steal their stuff. I have various pirates aboard, but my gunnery crew consists of yourselves, with the exception of Tom Senior, who was knocked overboard by a cannonball whilst fishing and sadly drowned. My personal rules prevent reloading. Sorry, Tom, you were a stalwart while you lived."
Thank you, man.
"There are various things you can add to your ship to enhance your crew, including building a library, have weights aboard to increase your pirate's strength, and create a room full of toys that build upgrade points by playing with them. You can switch your pirates into training mode so that during downtime they will level up at these pursuits. Sadly, while doing these things, they neglect more important ship work, like repairs, cooking, or most importantly, throwing their poo overboard. When the level of extant poo becomes untenable, triggering an understandable crisis of morale, you can switch your pirates back to crew mode so they deal with it. However, while the pirates that are reading, lifting weights, or training with swords immediately stop these activities in order to fling their poo in the sea, the pirates that are playing with toys won't. They play until they're knee-deep in their own shit, ignoring their own salvation and the concerns of those around them." He does have a question for us. The massive blue... I didn't know whether to read this out, because I have got a story for it. How close have any of you come to this particular situation in your own lives?
Oh my god.
I feel like sometimes people just want to tell us a story and then they think, oh shit, this is supposed to be a question. At the end, have you had this story?
So when I was in Kenya, obviously, hygiene and cleanliness of the things we were eating wasn't necessarily always obtainable, and every one of us suffered from certain bowel trauma while we were out there. But one evening, as we were all sleeping in our beds, I felt terrible rumbling. I was in my sleeping bag, I'm like, oh, God, I'll sit this one out. And it just carried on getting louder and louder. Noise. Like, okay, I've got to go. And the toilet was like a long drop, which was like 50 yards away from the house. It was a long way away, a big concrete hole full of spiders and lizards and stuff. I didn't really want to go there in the middle of the night, but it was testament to my need that I eventually got up. But as I got up, my body shifted and things became only more urgent.
Oh, no.
I ran out and I realised I didn't have any toilet paper as I got into the outside. Ran back in, grabbed some toilet paper, realised I wasn't going to make it. So spread a plastic bag over my own doorstep and took a big old shit on it. So I have actually shat on my own doorstep.
You can put your own doggy bag first. That's, that's real training.
Yeah.
That's impressive. At least you tried.
I did try.
Were you distracted by some particularly good toys at the time?
Yes!
I could make it, but these toys are just so good. I can't believe how entertaining this is.
Yeah.
Some games are particularly obsessed by bodily functions. The early Sims games were. It says that, like, almost all of your micromanagement of your Sims was telling them to piss at the right time. Or do a shit, lest they vomit all over themselves. Like, the thing is, one
need
thing.
Shit so bad I could vomit.
One thing triggered the other. That's the thing. It's like, it's an endless cycle of fluids.
If you're gonna have an involuntary bodily function in response to bad and even to shit, I don't think it should be to vomit. It should be the other thing.
Well, also, Theme Hospital had the vomit event horizon, where, have we talked about that on the podcast before?
Sure. Oh, it's kind of a,
it's legend.
Yeah.
It's legend.
Go on, tell it again.
Well, then, you know, if there was a vomiting sickness that you could get in Theme Hospital, and, you know, it was curable, but if there were too many vomiting patients, it was impossible to hire enough cleaners to clean up the vomit. So there was an exponential increase in vomit until the entire hospital was just covered entirely in vomit, and your hospital inevitably failed because everyone was literally swimming through vomit to be cured. That's known as the vomit event horizon. Because once you're past that point, there's no going back.
Davey G says, "Dear CNC, really simple question. The Steam controller is available for pre-order at £39.99 sterling. Should I buy one? I currently use a wired 360 controller on my PC." And he carries on saying stuff.
and so on in this fashion. I pre-ordered one.
Well,
I think it's going to be great.
The Power Owl.
I badly need this thing, basically. This is the thing that I need, because I've got to the point where I just, in my leisure time, strongly prioritise games that I can play with a gamepad over mouse and keyboard, because I use mouse and keyboard all day for my work, and I get pretty bad RSI, and gaming time, it's like, it's not impossible for me to use a mouse and keyboard, and it's not necessarily painful every moment, but it sort of gets worse the longer I do it, and it really changes the way I kind of treat games. Like, if I know every moment I'm playing it is kind of bad for my hands and unpleasant, then certain types of games no longer seem appealing at all. And so I'm kind of struggling to get into Galcio, because you can only really play it with mouse and keyboard.
Oh, yeah.
And it just takes a fucking long time to play. It's just a really big, time-consuming game. And so it's just hard to kind of justify spending that much time on it when it's kind of hurting me all the time. And I think it might be kind of one of the reasons I really went cold on Civ at a certain point. I just really started to find the amount of time it took to take a turn was just really, really bothersome. And stuff like Invisible Ink, that's kind of why I love it, is because it doesn't really waste your time. And it's all the stuff, you spend most of your time thinking, and then when you need to do something, it's just quick. And there's no kind of attrition and kind of churn of, oh, I've got to move all my units. I didn't move this one. It won't let me end the turn. A thing that will let me control mouse-based games without having to be at my mouse and keyboard is very, very appealing.
I played with an earlier iteration of the Steam controller at a Gamescom. Possibly the last one or the one before, I can't remember. And it feels like something that could be great once you're used to it. I think you have to train yourself to use it properly, because it's got these dual trackpads for each thumb. They've added a thumbstick now, which is good for like general shooter movement. But the precise sensitivity of that, I think you'd have to tailor for yourself for it to actually work. And also, it only works like they were demoing it. Oh, it's a ParadoxCon, and they were demoing it with like Crusader Kings 2 on a big screen, and all of the buttons on Crusader on CK2 are tiny, really small. Yeah. So it was actually like getting a headshot every time you wanted to like hit a little button. Like it required a level of skill that I just didn't have yet with that controller. If that level of control becomes intuitive over time, then maybe it's like, it would be that super useful, and brilliant thing. I think you mentioned, the questioner mentions that, they're using a 360 pad wired into their PC.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that you'd want a Steam controller if you've already, like, unless maybe you have RSI problems, but, like, on your PC, it's designed obviously for a couch where it's wireless and you're sitting back on your couch and it lets you play Civ on your couch. That's the kind of the design intention of it. So,
yeah, maybe... he says he explicitly, he isn't streaming to his TV.
Mm.
Do you know if it's, can you just use it for like Windows? Can
yeah, behave like yeah, totally. Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah, totally. You can score websites and stuff.
Huh.
Cool. I don't know. I have to play with one. I like it's, you know, my purchase is coming this Christmas. It's definitely going to be the Vive, I think. Or whatever Oculus are announcing in 24 hours, 42 hours, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, like a countdown popped up.
Okay.
So what is, they don't have anything publicly released yet, do they?
No, this is going to be presumably announced at an actual commercial launch date. Yeah. And I wonder if they're going to try and beat
Yeah.
I feel like you gotta. Can't be too much later than Valve because Valve's thing is better.
Well, at least I'm gonna be. I'm gonna be smacked up on some kind of VR goggles by Christmas.
Smacked up on goggles.
Yeah, I'm gonna fucking sell the house. Just gonna be in my shed on a mattress.
I'm actually. I'm hopefully ready for it now because I've just bought a new graphics card. Mm. And previously, like I bought a new PC not too long ago, but I'd had this. So like a long time ago, I bought a new graphics card. Because it was the weakest element of my PC, and I sort of went for like a pretty good one. And it turned out to be like at the generational jump where they made them like 50% longer and bigger.
Oh, yeah.
And it was just physically too big for my case. It was just never
going to
go. There was just no way it would ever go in there. So I kept it until I upgraded my whole PC, which is like a year later. And so when I ordered a new PC, I had it without the graphics card so I could save some money, and then plugged the other one in. And it fit fine. But it wasn't as cutting edge as it was when I bought it, so it kind of depreciated in value to some extent. And also, it just sounded like a fucking jet engine. It was the most deafening, ridiculous thing. It was, so, like, most graphics cards these days are just silent when they're not being used for 3D stuff, and then when they are being used for 3D stuff, they spin up to some extent, so you hear them more. And this had, I think it must have been 6 or 7 different levels of fan usage, so you'd hear it, like, you start off, like The Witcher or something, when it's showing the menus, it'll spin up to a certain extent. And then, like, after about a minute, it'll spin up again and get louder. And it gets louder, and it gets louder, and it just keeps on getting louder, like, 6 or 7 times, to the point where you literally can't hear the dialogue of the game. It's just drowning out game sound. And it's, like, it's one thing to get used to some quite significant background noise, but when it's constantly changing like that, too, you just can't, it ruins the entire mood of the game, because it's basically like an escalating score to the game, saying, and if it's just like a relaxing scene of Geralt hanging around, that's just totally ruined the atmosphere. So I've replaced that now, so my new graphics card is also very, very good.
Did you go Nvidia?
I might never buy it. It was a Sapphire Radeon, and I'll never buy that combination again for sure. It's unusable. It's just absurd. I just didn't think about humans using this product ever.
Was it a 9 series?
Yeah, so I went for, can't remember what manufacturer it was. It was the one that does Strix cooling. Because noise was a concern, I looked at all the different cooling methods, and it was Strix Twin Frozers.
Frozers?
Yeah, Forzr.
That's really not a word.
And I can't remember what the other one was. Like Hypercool X or something, you know.
Did it have a sexy elf on the box art?
I can't remember, actually.
Dear people who name graphics cards, grow up.
Anyway, the new one is you can't hear it at all, really. If there's any sound going on at all.
Yeah.
Even under full load.
I'm quite pleased with the one I got, which is also a 9 series, 970, I think.
Yeah. I got 970 as well. It's really nice.
Does The Witcher quite well. Mm. Even his hair. Even Geralt's lovely hair.
Yeah, hair
works. I had to turn TressFX off.
Really?
Well, I only got like 55 FPS with TressFX on. I wanted 60.
PC gaming.
Jess writes in to say, Dear Morten Jobar, which is clever
pun. Oh, nice.
Since the recent cinematic release of Mad Max Fury Road, I can see the relevance of that pun now. I've been on a bit of a post-apocalypse kick. What games have you encountered that do an explicitly poke-apocalypse world? rather than the kinds of games which you need to dig through the backstory to find out that it's been a post-apocalypse. But that, believably or entertainingly, question mark, says Jess.
Well, Overland, but that's not out yet.
Oh, yeah.
If Graham were here, I'm sure he'd say NEO Scavenger, or Neo Scavenger, whatever it is. That's cool. Very, very post-apocalypse.
It's a good one.
You can't miss the apocalypse.
I think I talked about it on the podcast before, Enslaved, which is a Ninja Theory game, which is kind of not great in a lot of ways, but like...
Really pretty, though, isn't it?
It's really pretty. Well, it was really pretty when it came out. And it was one of the first games to do the kind of massively overgrown apocalypse, which since has become, like, one of the standard forms of apocalypse one can have. Well, with, you know, peanut butter flavour, strawberry flavour, overgrown, irradiated.
Four art styles of the apocalypse. Beheld on a pale horse.
Yeah. But that's good fun. It's got an interesting backstory written by Alex Garland, but it's hard to access that story, really. But it's got good characters, and it's cool. Interesting.
Is that the one based on Monkey Goes...
Journey to the West, based on the... Any suggestions?
No. I was going to say Neo Scavenger, which is super post-apocalyptic.
Well, that's two. What more do you want?
Yeah,
absolutely.
Three.
Trevor says, "Evening, folks." We'll synopsize this large email. I would like to say, though, his entire email is perfectly spelt, except for his repeated use of the word roguelike, which he misspells every single time in different ways. So he spells it right. I can only imagine this is intentional.
Roguelike.
Yeah, he says roguelike, roguelikes, roguelikes, and rugoelic.
Yeah, that sounds like my original.
So anyway, his thrust is that he feels too guilty to include people he knows in roguelikes where it is possible to name characters. So he eschews that, and he instead thinks that it would be good to be able to carry on character, have a series of pre-built characters across games, I think. A character cache, if you will, he says. This is a feature that I actually thought would be a great means of spewing out emergent experiences. At the beginning of a campaign, someone could select among their pre-built people, which could even extend to the glorious victors saved from previous games. Further still, as characters are randomly generated, there could be a minute chance that they would be pre-selected from your Lego prefabs. Giving the player an immediate sense of connection with his digital agent. Do you think, so he says, do you copy real people into your roguelikes? Does a bank of pre-made characters that might randomly pop into a game sound appealing? Does anyone actually spend their time to copy their real face to BioWare's face-generating technology? Coming in hot from Arizona, Trevor.
I think that's a good idea. I used to always fantasize, about a system where I used to get particularly, like, I always use weird control systems, so I'd get sick of having to set my control system for every single game, and I always thought there should be, like, on my computer, I should have a profile file that says, here's what I like to use for shoot, here's what I like to use for use, here's what I like to use for duck. And I, like, extended that further into, like, in RPGs, I'm always going to go for the speedy character. I don't want much health. Like, a bit of strength. Maybe if there's magic, I'll have some of that. And then, like, I can build that into the profile, too. So you have the controls, and then you say, also, I like to have agile characters in RPGs.
Yeah.
It would be nice to have, a agnostic character profile, which actually has personality traits and also has some kind of relative kind of sense of progression that other games could then use. But I think that would be quite a big ask, really.
Yeah, on reflection, it's not that much of a chore to configure a character. Like, I'm not like, when an RPG starts, I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, I've got to put all the points in speed again. I'm so sick of doing this.
The first thing I thought when XCOM 2 was announced was, I get to bring Sergeant Balls back. a man who I named while drunk. My campaigns in XCOM often punctuated by certain sessions where I come back after the pub and decide I want to play XCOM. And then, Commander is drunk. Commander has gotten everyone killed. And Sergeant Balls was a particularly tragic instance because Owen Hill, my then editor, also died trying to save him.
Oh no.
But Balls nonetheless was mauled to death by a giant disc creep thing.
Tragedy of Balls.
Balls tragedy was, has weighed on my soul ever since. And, so in XCOM 2 he's coming back, and like whenever there's kind of militaristic thing and I get to go create someone, I will make a Sergeant Balls, because he's canon now. He's like canon in my life, my virtual life somehow. It's very strange. I wish I hadn't named him that.
I got a lot of fun out of naming my XCOM squad after I just made it like a voluntary thing on Twitter. So I said, if you want to be in my XCOM squad, then like favorite this or reply. And just got a huge list of names that way. And some of the people I knew and some of the people I didn't know. I always remember, I'll probably get his name wrong now, but I think Bobby Blackthorn is like a real name of somebody who follows me on Twitter apparently. He was like one of my best assault guys. And then I think he got like the nickname Blackout or something, because it was Bobby Blackout Blackthorn. It was awesome. But then I had, it got really interesting when I had Ashley Birch, Anthony Birch, and Steve Gaynor all in the same game for XCOM. Because, Steve Gaynor and Anthony Birch are very competitive for some reason. And so constantly want to like, do better than the other one in my game. And one of them became the first one to have their limbs cut off and become an ultra mech.
Oh, yeah.
And then I think the other one was the next one to do that. And I think, I can't remember which brand it was, but I think either Ashley or Anthony died trying to save either Ashley or Anthony. So, their brother and sister connection in real life, like, was added meaning to what happened in the game.
One of the PC gamers' great failed experiments was an attempt to create a cache of names that people could just go to and just like pick one out if they had to name someone in an RPG. So the way that we definitely shouldn't have done it was to create just a spreadsheet that was open to the entire world. To which anyone could just contribute to. And oh my god, it was quite a sight. Just going in there, just seeing the shit that people were just putting in, like it was going at like 2 frames a second, and expletives just sort of exploding out of this spreadsheet. That was, it was great. Really fun.
I don't know if it was PC Gamer, but some Facebook account that I officially liked, the polls would be like, oh, what do you think about this? Option A, option B, option C, option D would be frog, and option E would be, when will you learn to disable adding to poll options?
Yeah. Done that as well.
I always spend loads and loads of time on face editors. Do you guys not do that?
For my own character, I do.
Oh, yeah.
I get frustrated by... So I had a terrible time with Dragon Age Inquisition because I kind of want to see all the lighting conditions and all the ways.
Oh, God, yeah. I have to restart like 8 times.
Yeah,
again.
Sure.
Just be like, oh, I got it perfect. And then, nope, makeup wrong. As soon as you show me the first scene of the game, got to restart.
I made a real effort to recreate our mutual friend Kim in Bloodborne. I just spent fucking hours. It was so stupid. I wanted to play this game desperately, and in the end, I spent like 3 hours just looking at this fucking, moving the nose sliders around.
Yeah.
And then for the entire like first 5 hours of the game, you wear a costume which has like a bandana over your face. They couldn't even see it. You couldn't even see anything.
Yeah.
But there definitely should be. Yeah, character creators definitely need a real world. Like lighting option, because they're all in this weird idealized like studio room when you create the character, and then as soon as you put it in the game, it's always worse. It's always like, oh my god, you fucked it up. And like the only characters the ones I stick with are the ones who are like, well, you haven't totally ruined it, I guess. You made it much, much worse. But
yeah,
if it was just like whatever the first room of the game is, make that the character creator room as well, so that will look right there.
Evil Lion's character creator lets you just click a button to change lighting conditions and cycle through them. That's all it needs.
Did you guys transfer your Mass Effect characters between Mass Effects?
Yeah.
Because bad things happened to my guy's face. That's real bad things.
I had to do some structural work.
Yeah, me too.
Oh no, I left it as a horrible walking hemorrhoid of a man. Yeah, it's great. Mr. Gel writes in to inform us, dearest of the creators, Great Bar and Crows, he says, I'll just synopsize this, but he confirms, in fact, that you can refund games and yet keep the Steam, trading cards that you earned whilst playing it. So that's interesting, isn't it?
And sell them for money.
Not much money though, they're
one pence per card.
It's Mr. Gel, who says, much love. And on that happy note, that's all the questions that we have time to read out this particular episode.
Good questions this week.
Yeah, good questions. Yeah.
You can send us questions at questions@creatingcrowbar.com. You can tweet questions at us. We're @creatingcrowbar on Twitter. And you can also follow us. Oh, you can write them on the forums, creatingcrowbar.com/forum. And you can follow us individually. I am @pentadact, P-E-N-T-A-D-A-C-T.
I'm @PCTLudo, L-U-D-O.
And I'm @Marge Davies, which is D-A-B-I-E-S.
Thanks for listening, everybody! Bye.